This message is a presentation of Pinnacle Baptist Church and the preaching ministry of Pastor Ray McBerry. Other messages like this are available online at pinnaclebaptist.com. The church is located at 2517 High Falls Road in Griffin, Georgia. If you're in the area, we would love for you to visit us this Sunday. Now, here's today's message.
Well, we're in chapter 21 of the book of Acts. And before we pick up where we left off last week, I want to do something on the board up here. I want to give you just a little bit of a diagram of the temple there in Jerusalem, because it's going to play a major role in what we read in the rest of Acts chapter 21. And so I want you to have an idea of what we're talking about. So if you look up here at the board, you'll see the innermost part of the temple. Now, the temple was laid out the same basic format, the layout of the tabernacle, the plans that God gave Moses for the tabernacle up on Mount Sinai. So when they built the temple, both Solomon's temple, which was the original temple, and now this temple that was rebuilt when Ezra and Nehemiah returned and they rebuilt the city of Jerusalem, rebuilt the walls, and then finally also rebuilt the temple. This temple is nothing to compare in size or magnificence, we're told in the Bible, to the original Solomon's temple. But this one is still patterned after the same basic design as the first temple, which was patterned after the tabernacle. So here's the innermost part of the temple. This first part is called the holy place. What's this part that's a smaller room? When you go through the holy place, what's this back room here, the innermost part of it? The Holy of Holies, that's right, or the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. Now, in the Holy of Holies, there was only one piece of furniture. What was that one piece of furniture in the Holy of Holies? Yes, sir? The Ark of the Covenant, that's right. Now, at this point, in the time of Christ, the time of the early church, the Ark of the Covenant was not there. The Ark of the Covenant had been removed when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem the first time. The Ark of the Covenant was taken out of the temple, Solomon's temple that had been built. And there are lots of mystery stories that have been written or produced on television about where they think the ark was taken, who took it. Very possibly the prophet Jeremiah had something to do with that. Back when Nebuchadnezzar was besieging the city, it's believed that perhaps the ark was either gotten out of the city or it might be in one of the underground passages there in the city of Jerusalem. But that was the only piece of furniture in the Holy of Holies, the most holy part of the temple. And then in the part that the priests would go through before this curtain that separated it from the Holy of Holies, in the holy place there were several pieces of furniture. There was the table of showbread. There was the golden candlestick. There was also the altar of incense. So there were three pieces of furniture in the holy place. I won't try to draw that because we're not particularly interested in that this morning. But this is the inner part of the temple. Now, around the inner part of the temple, there was a courtyard that, if it had the dimensions that were given in the book of Exodus, where God gave Moses the dimensions for the tabernacle, and we believe the temple was probably laid out in the same fashion, then this outer court would have been about the size of a football field. It would have been very similar. I'm sorry, half a football field. So you've got a pretty large area here on the outer part. And this court would have been called the court of the Jews. So anyone who was a Jew could go into this courtyard area here. The courtyard area here was reserved just for the Jews. Gentiles couldn't go there. Even proselyte Gentiles who had become Jews couldn't go there. Now, when the temple was built, there was also a covered area, kind of like a covered walkway when you first went into the court of the Jews. This was called the court of women. So the Jewish women could go into this part, but they were not usually allowed into the rest of the outer court. But as Jews, they could still go into this part. Now, this is what the tabernacle looked like that Moses and the children of Israel carried throughout the desert for 40 years. But when they built the temple in Jerusalem, there was also another courtyard that was even beyond the outer court. And it had openings all along the sides of it that were called gates. I don't know that I've put the right number of gates in my drawing here. I wasn't paying close enough attention to that as I was drawing. But this is basically what the large courtyard outside the court of the Jews looked like. And it would have been called the court of the Gentiles. And even Gentiles were allowed in this area here. If you remember the story where Jesus drove out the money changers, that's where animals were sold to be used for sacrifices inside the inner court of the temple itself. So this is where the animals would have been bought and sold for offering sacrifices and things like that. Even the Gentiles were allowed in here as long as they met certain requirements. So as we go through the story in the rest of Acts chapter 21, the layout of this is going to play a significant part in the rest of the story. I'll also say this just so that you have an understanding of what was outside of this court of the Gentiles. All around it, there was like a portico, like a big porch with columns all around the outside, even of the court of the Gentiles. Now, down here in this corner, attached to the temple, was a fort, a Roman fort, a castle, if you would. And that is going to come into play in the story as well. But the Romans had built this bastion, this castle, for the Roman garrison that was stationed in downtown Jerusalem to keep law and order, basically. So keep all of this in mind as we go through the rest of Acts 21. So we're in Acts 21. We read verse 21 last Sunday, but I'm going to go back and reread it. Remember, this is the rumor that is being spread among the unbelieving Jews in Jerusalem about Paul. So when Paul shows up, the Jews are already spreading false rumors about him. Look what it said in verse 21. And they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. Now, we won't go back through the big discussion that we had last Sunday morning about what Paul did and didn't say. But just to put it in a nutshell, Paul had told everyone when they got saved, you don't have to keep the law in order to go to heaven. But he did not tell them that they could not do those things, that they should not do those things. He left it up to them. If they were Jews and they wanted to keep their customs, he said, do it if you want to, but you don't have to do it to go to heaven, and you don't have to do it any longer to be right with God. And so he was not telling them not to do those things, But the unbelieving Jews were spreading the rumor among the rest of the Jews there in Jerusalem that this fellow was telling Jews not to keep Jewish customs anymore. In other words, he was trying to destroy their heritage, their customs, and their culture. Verse 22, "What is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come." So the apostles there in Jerusalem are telling Paul, listen, when they find out you're here, they're going to come looking for you. We're talking about those that are trying to stir things up, of course. Verse 23, "Do therefore this that we say to thee. We have four men which have a vow on them. Them take and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law." They're telling Paul that they've got four men among their members, that is, men in the church, that have shaved their heads and taken a vow, and they're encouraging Paul to do the same thing. Now, there are two important aspects to this. First of all, the reason these men had shaved their heads and the kind of vow that they had taken was the kind of vow that Jews would take if they had been to some other place outside of Judea, outside of the land of the Jews, Gentile lands, if you would. And before they could go inside the temple area, even as Jews, because they had profaned themselves in their travels to Gentile lands, they would go through, they would shave their heads as a sign to everybody else they were taking a vow to purify themselves. And then they would spend a certain number of days before they would allow themselves to go into the temple area. So that was the reason they were doing it. Now the church is asking Paul to do that with these four church members. Well, we know Paul's been outside in Gentile lands. He's been out there starting churches on his missionary journeys. And so that's one of the reasons they're asking him to do this. The second reason is so that the other Jews, when they see that Paul is doing what any good Jew would do, it's going to be kind of hard for those that are trying to stir something up to say, well, Paul's trying to do away with our customs and our culture and our laws as Jews, when they see that he's following them. So that's why they're encouraging Paul to do the same thing as these four men. Now, Paul, we know, based on what he's already told people, he knows he doesn't have to do this in order to be saved. He's already saved. He doesn't have to do this to be right with God, because we live under a new covenant, not the old covenant. But he's going to do this for the same reason we saw him ask Timothy to be circumcised earlier in the book of Acts, so that he can minister to the Jews and they will listen to him without just closing him off, refusing to even hear what he has to say. So let's continue on here. Verse 25, "As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, and from blood, and from strangled, and from fornication." So this is going back to the same conversation. The apostles are saying, we're still telling Gentile believers that they don't have to keep Jewish customs or culture, just like when you came before and we had that, what was called the Jerusalem Conference, where Paul had come down and had that discussion with the other apostles earlier in the book of Acts when we saw that. Because the other apostles apparently were allowing some of the men in the church that were Jews to teach the Gentile believers they had to basically become Jews in order to be Christians. And so they're reminding Paul, or they're reaffirming to Paul, that they're still telling the Gentiles they don't have to adopt Jewish culture once they get saved. the same things that they had had those conversations about previously, so we won't go into those things again. Verse 26, then Paul took them in, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So Paul, he's going to take a vow himself, and this is as much for his testimony to the Jews there as it is to for any other reason. He knows that this isn't anything to do with his relationship with God. It's solely for his relationship with his fellow countrymen. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. Now it says Paul went into the temple, but Paul would have been in this part of the temple, the court of the Gentiles. Because even though he had taken that vow to purify himself, he was allowed in the court of the Gentiles because even the Gentiles were allowed there. So he would have been in this area of the courtyard, in and around the temple. Remember, he's there, and because of the holy day that was upon them, there are thousands upon thousands of Jews that are there, some that live there and some that are just making their pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So there are thousands of people every day mingling around with one another in the temple and in the Temple Mount and the downtown Jerusalem area. People from all over the Roman Empire that are Jews have come to be there for this occasion. So some of these unbelieving Jews from Asia Minor, where Paul has established churches in those cities, they've already tried to run Paul out of their cities on several occasions. They've tried to stir up not only the other Jews against Paul, they tried to stir up the Gentiles against Paul on several occasions that we've seen already in the book of Acts. Now some of them are in Jerusalem for their annual pilgrimage, and some of them spot Paul in the temple. Now, he's in this area, which is lawful even for a Jew to be when he's not yet performed his vows, but he has not yet gone into the inner part of the temple. Hey, brother, that's okay. That door does that all the time. It does it all the time. We're in Acts chapter 21, Brother John. So Paul is there. He's in the court of the Gentiles. He's not in the inner part of the temple. But these Jews that are trying to stir stuff up, the facts don't mean anything to them. You've met people like that before when they wanted to push forth a rumor or a story. Facts never seem to get in the way of somebody that's trying to create an issue. And that's the way it was with these Jews there in Jerusalem. It says in verse 27, when the 7 days were almost ended, so he was still under his vow. He had not gone into the inner part of the temple yet. The Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. So they got to spreading the word around. Here he is, the one who's been telling all the Jews not to observe our customs anymore, not to observe our culture anymore. Here he is. And a mob. I mean, there's already thousands of people there, many of whom don't even live there. And they're easily able to arouse the passions of the crowd there, and a mob forms. It says, and they laid their hands on him. This mob grabbed him in the middle of all these people. Verse 28, crying out, men of Israel, help. This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple, and hath polluted this holy place. Parentheses. For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus and Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. So he's somewhere here in the court of the Gentiles. We don't know exactly where he was in the court of the Gentiles, but these Jews see him, and they make two false assumptions, and they begin spreading two lies. First of all, that Paul has been in the temple before his 7 days of purification have passed. And secondly of all, he's got a Gentile with him, one of these Christians, and he's taken that Gentile somewhere here inside the temple in the court of the Jews, in the inner part of the temple. So they're accusing him of two things, and of course the overarching thing they're accusing him of is telling all the Jews that they shouldn't observe their practices under the Mosaic law anymore. Remember, Paul didn't tell them not to do those things. He just told them you don't have to do those things to go to heaven, and you don't have to do those things to be right with God. But he was not telling them to just abolish their culture, their history, their heritage, and their practices. He didn't tell them they had to. He just told them you don't have to do that to be right with God. So here we are. They're lying about him. They've created a mob, and they've laid hands on him. Verse 30. And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. Now, even the Jews would not have done anything related to violence to another person inside the temple area itself. Not even in the court of the Gentiles. So what it's telling us here is that the mob dragged Paul out through one of these gates. And once they got him somewhere outside the gates, outside the portico, out here on the exterior of the temple, they're intending to kill him. They're intending to do violence to him, but they won't do it inside the temple. That's why they've dragged him outside. And then somebody closed the doors so that he couldn't get back inside the temple. Because if he got back in the courtyard area of the temple, he could have some refuge there. They couldn't do any violence to him. Verse 31. And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. All right, now, who is the captain of the band, the chief captain of the band? He's the one who's over the Roman soldiers that are there. Now, normally, the police, if we want to call it that, who kept order in and around the temple and on the Temple Mount, those would have been those who worked for the Sanhedrin, those who worked for the priests there in the temple. They had their own police themselves that took care of the law and order among the Jews. The Jews did not want the Romans to get involved in their own keeping of the laws and policing the place. And to be honest with you, the Romans really didn't want to be involved in that either. They pretty much left it to the Jews to rule themselves as long as they kept law and order. But when this mob action begins to take place, probably somewhere on this side of the temple, the chief captain of the Roman garrison here hears that sounds like there's some kind of riot going on. And so he's going to leave this castle and he's going to come out to see what the situation is. That's where we are right here. Verse 32, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. All right, what's a centurion? He's a leader of 100. That's century, centurion. He's a soldier who's an officer over 100 men. And ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. So these people were intending to beat Paul to death right outside the temple. But when they see the Roman soldiers coming down and the captain of the guard, they all scurry, just like a bunch of roaches when you turn the light on. They all take off and leave Paul standing there. Verse 33. Then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains and demanded who he was and what he had done. Well, they rescued him, but then they immediately put him into chains. So he went from one horrible situation to a situation that's still not a good situation. He's in shackles. And some cried one thing, some another among the multitude. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. This was like any other mob. Some of the people that were part of the mob were the people that had stirred everybody up. They knew exactly what they were trying to have Paul killed over. But then there were a bunch of other people that were just there, and they didn't really know what it was all about. As with any mob that forms just kind of instantaneously like this, there were some people undoubtedly that they didn't really know what it was all about, but everybody was moving in the same direction. Everybody was fired up about something. And so they were going to be part of it too. And I'm sure there were rumors that were spreading is it was this or it was that. But the captain of the guard, he didn't know what to make of things. So he's going to take Paul with him up into the Roman castle that's right there beside the temple. And when he came upon the stairs, so it was, that he was borne of the soldiers for the violence of the people. That is Paul. He's literally having to be carried away by the Roman soldiers to get him away from the people. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him." So this mob, they dispersed for the soldiers to come in and get Paul. But they're not going away. They're following the soldiers now as the soldiers take Paul back up to the castle, which is connected to the temple. And as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, "May I speak unto thee?" Who said, "Canst thou speak Greek? Art not thou that Egyptian which before these days madest an uproar and leddest out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers?" So the captain of the guard here, he has mistaken Paul for being someone else. There was previously, just a couple of years before this and leading right up to this same time, there was a fellow who had tried to get the Jews to revolt against Rome, and he had got into the desert areas outside of Jerusalem, and there were several thousand Jewish men that they were wanting Israel to have her independence from Rome. They had followed this fellow, and they were kind of like Robin Hood and his band of merry men, and they were making havoc, interfering with the Roman supplies that were coming to Jerusalem. They were trying to constantly harass not only the Romans, but any Jews that they knew of that were cooperating with the Romans there in Jerusalem. They caused them problems, burned their homes, in some cases murdered some people. So that's who this man thinks Paul is, this Jewish nationalist who's trying to rid Israel of the Romans. Of course, that's not who Paul is, and it's not about anything political that's going on. Look what Paul said in verse 39. But Paul said, "I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. And I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people." All right, now we've already had a conversation previously in our study here in the book of Acts about Paul and about his citizenship. But just to remind us, remember, citizens had rights and privileges that the average person in the Roman Empire did not have. Up until about 20 or 30 years ago, it was the same way here in these United States. Citizens had certain rights that foreigners did not have who were not citizens yet at that point. But under the Roman Empire, it was a much a much bigger gap between the rights of a citizen and the rights of everybody else. The Roman Empire had grown so large and encompassed most of the Mediterranean world and even beyond at this point that those who were citizens could expect to be treated the same as a Roman citizen back in Rome, even if they were in one of these far-flung places of the empire, provinces that were a long ways away from Rome. As long as you were a Roman citizen, you still had those guarantees, those protections of some basic rights that citizens had. We'll talk more about what those rights were as we finish up the book of Acts. As we go through, we're going to encounter some more of these. But for this morning, suffice it to say that Paul is letting this chief captain of the guard know that he's a citizen. Because right now, this fellow doesn't know he's a citizen. And when Paul lets him know he's a Roman citizen, that's a code word to the captain of the guard. Hey, I've got to treat this fellow differently than I was about to treat him. I've got to treat him differently than I would treat any of these other people here in whatever this is that's going on. Because he was a Roman citizen. But he was a Jew. So Paul has to explain to him how he, as a Jew, could be a Roman citizen. Remember, not only were the Jews, the typical Jews, weren't citizens at all. They were just, they lived in the Roman Empire because they had been conquered like a bunch of other people, but they weren't citizens, most of them. And to make matters worse, remember just a few chapters back we read in Acts where Caesar had ordered all the Jews out of Italy, out of all of Italy, because he didn't like the Jews because of all the other things that were going on. So on top of everything, Paul's a Jew, but he needs to make it clear to this officer that he's a Roman citizen. Now he tells him that the reason he's a Roman citizen is he's from the city of Tarsus. And we know that. He's Saul of Tarsus. That's his hometown. That's where he's from. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but as a reminder, Tarsus was the chief city in that part of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And this particular city was kind of the Roman capital in that part of Asia Minor. The Romans had been well received by the city of Tarsus when they conquered it. The city fathers didn't try to put up a big defense of the city. They willingly turned the city over to the Romans and they had, as a result, not suffered destruction of their city. They had basically become the Roman capital in that region of the Roman Empire. In exchange for the fact that Rome didn't have to conquer the city, Rome had bestowed the gift of citizenship on the city of Tarsus. That is, all the citizens of Tarsus, in one stroke of a pen, became citizens of the Roman Empire. Now, why would Rome do that? Well, you know, if you're still out trying to conquer other people, other places, if you set a good example for these people just giving you their city without putting up a fight, well, hopefully some other folks will decide to do that, and it'll save on soldiers, save on war costs, save on lives, and everything will be a whole lot easier if people just surrender to you. It's similar to what the ancient Assyrians did, but they would take the people out of the cities that fought against them and do hideous things to them to intimidate the next city down the road. The Romans here are offering a gift instead to those that would surrender their cities. So that's why Tarsus, the citizens of Tarsus, were citizens of the Roman Empire. There are some Bible scholars who say that even as a citizen of Tarsus, Paul's father, his family being Jews, would not have automatically gained Roman citizenship even if the rest of the people in Tarsus did, because Jews were normally treated differently than everybody else. So there are some who believe that Paul's father must have done some special deed to have been granted citizenship individually before Paul was born. But then once Paul was born, being born the son of a citizen, he gained his citizenship that way. Whichever it is, Paul, we know from Scripture, in numerous places, was a Roman citizen. So he's going to be entitled to different treatment than the average person would be. This is going to play a major, major role in the rest of the book of Acts, so keep it in mind. Verse 40, and when he had given him license, what's the word license mean?
Permission,
that's right. So Paul's asked if he could speak to the people as they're going up the stairs into the castle. So once this fellow finds out Paul's a citizen, he gives Paul permission. Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with a hand unto the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying. So here he is, he's on this staircase going up into the castle. He asks the captain, can I say a few words to these people that are trying to kill me? Once the fellow is pretty well satisfied that Paul is a Roman citizen, he agrees to let him say something. After all, he really doesn't have any right anymore to have him in bonds. This is a Roman citizen, and to the best of his knowledge, he hasn't broken any Roman laws. So he's certainly not going to say no, that he can't speak to the crowd. So Paul turns around, faces the crowd, puts his hand up, trying to get everybody quiet. And once the crowd kind of settles down a little bit to see what this fella has to say, Paul begins to speak. But he doesn't speak in the Greek tongue, like he was probably speaking to this centurion. Instead, he speaks in the Hebrew tongue. That's the tongue of the people that are trying to kill him. They're his fellow countrymen. Number one, this identifies him with those he's talking to, so they know he's one of them. It couldn't help but endear him at least maybe a little bit to them when they realize he is one of them. But number two, him speaking in the Hebrew tongue, it's also going to leave the captain out of the conversation, because he's a Roman. He might speak Latin. He definitely speaks Greek. But he sure don't speak Hebrew, at least not much. So he's not going to know what's going on, but Paul's going to now have a dissertation in front of the mob speaking in the Hebrew language. And if you want to know what he has to say to the mob, you'll have to come back next week. All right, any questions this morning about anything we've talked about? I want to just point out a couple of important things. First of all, the layout of the temple, if you remember this, or at least try to hold on to it, it'll help you in your understanding of a lot of the other stories in the Gospels during the life of Christ, and also in the book of Acts, things around the temple. Secondly of all, remember that Paul is a Roman citizen. It's going to be a major thing in the rest of the book of Acts. And then thirdly of all, remember, like we talked about, Paul was not telling them that they were not supposed to continue to keep the Mosaic Law. He didn't tell them that they couldn't do that. What he told them is you don't have to do it anymore. And same with us. As I've said before, I have encountered, seems like, a growing movement among Christians who think that as Christians, we are under the Mosaic Law and have to observe the feast days and the holy days and the different parts of the Mosaic Law as Christians. That's not the case. The Old Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant, was for Israel. It was not for the church. We're the church. We're under the New Covenant. And the book of Hebrews calls it, by the way, a better covenant. And I don't know about you, but I'm glad I'm under the New Covenant, not the Old Covenant. It never applied to Gentiles in the first place, and it doesn't apply even to Jews today either, the old covenant, if they're saved. Because everyone who's saved today is under the new covenant, not the old covenant. But Paul didn't tell them they couldn't do those things that were part of their heritage, part of their culture. If they wanted to do them, they could. And if they wanted to be able to reach the other Jews, they probably were going to have to do some of those things just so the Jews would accept them enough to listen to them. Same as a missionary on the foreign field. Missionaries sometimes have to do things and follow customs in places where they serve that they wouldn't normally follow back here. The missionary knows he doesn't have to do those things to be right with God, but if he wants those people he's ministering to listen to what he says, he can't offend them in any way. And so that's what Paul has told the Jews that were believers. All right, any questions? Any comments? Lord, thank you for an opportunity to study the book of Acts. Lord, as we continue in the book, help us, I pray, not just to learn it as a historical narrative, but Lord, show us the doctrinal truths and the practical implications for our lives on a daily basis. Help us to be people of the book, to allow you to live through us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.